want to give a little bit of an understanding of the whole parish of Mechiras Yosef. Not going to be able to go into all the details, but at least to get a little bit of an overview of what happened there. First, a few hakadamos. Yosef, basically throughout history, Yosef and Shevet Yosef were the trailblazers for everything that would come afterwards. Yosef himself felt himself the preparer of his brothers for their future missions and future roles in Klal Yisrael. And Yoshua from Yosef paved the way for conquering Eretz Yisrael. The Mashiach ben Yosef will pave the way for Mashiach ben David. And Yosef is always the preparation, the preparer. Yosef was somewhere between a Shevet and an Av. He wasn't one of the Avos, but to a certain degree, his children were Shvatim. So in that way, he was on the same level of the Avos. He had all the qualities. Each of Yaakov's children had one aspect of his personality. Yehuda had Malchus, and Levi had Kahuna, and so on. Yosef, it says, was a spitting image of Yaakov Avinu. That means that he had within him all of the kochos of Yaakov in a miniature way, because of this role that he would play to prepare the other Shvatim for their roles. He had to be able to have, in some way, all the roles mixed in. That's one thing about Yosef. We'll get to something more about this part in a second. But before that, there was an ongoing argument amongst the Shvatim, basically Yosef against the other brothers, of what their status was. This is something that many different commentaries say in one way or another. The question was, are they already the beginning of Klal Yisrael, and they are already Yisrael, and it's just a matter that they're just a small fledgling nation? Or no, they are regular B'nai Noach. Yisrael hasn't started yet. Yisrael won't start till the giving of the Torah. And they are a nation in preparation, but they're not a nation yet. And they don't have the status of Yisrael. And there's a lot of laws that change if you're Yisrael or you're a Ben Noach. Yosef held that their status was B'nai Noach. They were regular B'nai Noach, who had maybe had some extra mitzvahs, like the mitzvah Bris Milah or whatever, but otherwise they had all the laws of a Ben Noach, and they were in the preparatory stage of becoming a Jewish people. But that wouldn't come till later. Because of that, Yosef saw his role as being the one, since the role of all of the other ones didn't start yet. Yehuda yet wasn't the Melech, and Levi wasn't yet the Kohuna or whatever. So Yosef was the one to prepare them for their role. And therefore, that was his, they weren't yet starting on their role, they were just in the preparation stage, that was his role, to prepare them. The brothers held that they already had the status of Yisrael. They were already a nation, and each one began his role. Yehuda was a little king in a little country that had 11 brothers or whatever, and so on. And they already were starting on their role, and they already had the status of Yisrael. We'll see where the differences are in a few seconds. And therefore, the brothers looked at Yosef as if he was usurping their roles and doing what they were supposed to be doing, because they understood they're supposed to start doing it. And if he's doing it, then he is, encroaching on their role. Yosef looked at it, their roles didn't start yet. Their role's not going to start till much later when the Jewish people are formed, and then each tribe will take on its role. At this point, they're only in the preparatory stages, and he's the one who's helping them and preparing them for that role. It says that, Vayeshev Yaakov, the Eretz Megurei Aviv, Ela told us Yaakov, Yosef. Yosef was the par excellence tolda of Yaakov because he had all of his qualities, like we said. Hayaroa es echov batzol. He was a shepherd to his brothers, just like a shepherd brings up the sheep, takes care of them, prepares them for their future, whether they're going to be shechted or going to be used for their wool or whatever it's going to be. That's the purpose of the shepherd. So too, Yosef felt he shepherded his brothers together with the sheep. And he also defended B'nai Bilho, B'nai Zilpah. One of the differences, and this is what we'll see in a second, let's hold it for a minute. We'll see in a second how he defended his brothers from the children of the handmaidens. B'nai Zilpah, B'nai Vayove Yosef es dibosom royal avihim. He brought a bad report to his father. Now the Gemara says, Rashi brings down, what was the bad report? That they were eating Aver Menachai. They were eating flesh torn from a living animal. They were calling their brothers from the Shvachos, Avodim, slaves. And they were promiscuous. Three things, pretty serious things. Based on what I told you, the Mefarshim explained one way or another. The first one is pretty much generic, how everybody explains it. The halach is like this, that if you shecht an animal, okay, for a non-Jew is also not allowed to eat meat taken from a living animal. It's one of the seven mitzvahs of Noach, Eiver Menachai. If a non-Jew shechts an animal, after you shecht an animal, it still moves around for about 20 minutes after the shechita. That's called the mefarcheses. Okay, it's shechted. So from a Jewish standpoint, it's considered dead. After shechita, you can take a leg off and roast it and eat it. For a non-Jew, however, shechita is irrelevant. It has to be dead, no movement. So for a non-Jew, in those 20 minutes, for a Jew who pulls off a leg from an animal that had shechita, it's kosher. For a non-Jew, it's not kosher. So, whether it's... That's the brothers considered themselves Jews. And therefore, as soon as they shechted the animal, they didn't wait and they took the meat off the animal. Yosef considered them non-Jews. What they were doing was 100% wrong. So he went and told his father. We'll see in one second what the problem was. So Yosef was right and they were right. Questions on your perspective. The second thing it says, they were calling their brothers who were the handmaidens slaves. What does it mean? If you hold that the brothers, they had a status of Jews, then the halacha is that a Jew who lives with a shifcha, with a slave woman, the children are slaves. But a non-Jew, there the halacha is that the children go after the father. So according to Yosef, that they were non-Jews, the brothers from the handmaidens were the progeny of Yaakov. They weren't slaves. But according to the brothers that they were Jews, they were considered slaves. Now Yaakov could have freed them, the handmaidens, or be Magayer them, right, and then they wouldn't be slaves anymore. But Yosef knew that his father agreed with him that they had the status of non-Jews. So there's no purpose to let them free or whatever. The children were 100% okay. They were non-Jews like anybody else. They weren't slaves. They went after the father, not after the mother. But according to halacha, if they're Jews, then they go after the mother, not after the father. So Yosef was basically saying, my brothers, because they hold they have a status of Jews, are basically saying that their brothers are slaves. They didn't necessarily have to say it. That's what is implied by their opinion. And the third thing, they were promiscuous. Yosef held that since there was no barrier between them and the non-Jewish women, because they all had the same status, they had to be extra careful and couldn't do anything to have any connection to these women, even business connection, whatever. And he held that if they had any kind of connection, it was promiscuous. He was extra, Yosef was extra machmir. Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef we see in sexual things, was very careful. The brothers, on the other hand, held that they already had a din of Jews, and there was a natural separation. So they could have connection to these women in a totally business-like way, because there already was a buffer between them. They were Jews and they were non-Jews. Yosef was machmir, and the brothers were not machmir. But the problem with Yosef was, sometimes a person's machmir, he knows he's machmir, and somebody who's not machmir, right, is doing what the halacha says. But somebody who thinks that his chumrah is what's necessary, thinks that somebody who's not machmir is a shegit. So Yosef considered his brothers who were not machmir, right, doing something wrong. Because they weren't Jews, then there was no natural buffer between them and the other women. They both have the same status, and the chances of them taking that business relationship further was greater than if they knew they already were separated. They were Jews, they were non-Jews. They knew Jews and non-Jews didn't mix. But if non-Jews and non-Jews, there was no reason not to mix, and therefore they had to make some kind of fence to make that.
What? What did Yosef consider himself?
A Jew? A non-Jew.
So make it.
Because Yaakov probably never came out one way or the other. It's interesting. That's why it says that Yaakov taught Yosef all the Torah he learned from Shem and Aver. And didn't teach his other children Torah. The other children weren't interested. They say that's the past. We don't want to know what Shem and Aver. Shem and Aver was the Torah of Bnei Noach. We're no longer Bnei Noach. So the only one that had an open ear to that Torah was Yosef, because he held that they were still Bnei Noach. And it could be that Yaakov also wasn't 100% sure one way or the other. Yosef was sure, the other brothers were sure the other way, and it became a machlokas like that, and there was no Sanhedrin to decide it. In any case, so Yaakov understood. Then the next pasuk says, the Yisrael ohavis Yosef mikol echav. First time in the parasha it uses Yisrael. Till now it's always Yaakov. Yaakov, the personal individual. Yaakov didn't love Yosef more than the other brothers. Yisrael ohavis Yosef mikol echav. Now normally you translate that, and Yisrael loved Yosef more than the other brothers. Mikol banav. Right? But that's another way of learning it. Yaakov, as an individual father, loved all his children equally. But Yisrael, as the progenitor of the future nation, loved Yosef mikol banav, from all his brothers. The love of Yosef emanated from his love of all the other brothers. Since he loved all the other brothers, and each one had his role, and Yosef was going to be the one to prepare them for their role, so his love for all the brothers was included in the love for Yosef. Yosef's love wasn't just him personally, but he loved him as a result of his love for all the other brothers, and he was going to prepare all the other brothers for their role. So in loving the brothers, he loved Yosef because of them. Not mikol banav, what's it called, of more than, but from. The love of Yosef emanated from his love of all his sons. Since he loved them all, and each one he felt was special, Yosef was going to prepare them for their special role. So the love of Yosef wasn't just directed at Yosef personally. It was a love that emanated from all the other brothers, from all the other sons. When it speaks how the brothers looked at it, they looked at it differently. It says, "Vayiru echav, ki oso ohava aviha mikol echav," not mikol banav. Yaakov loved them more than the other brothers. They understood that Yaakov's love for Yosef didn't emanate from them. It wasn't that he loved him special, not because of him, because of them. But he loved them more than them. That it was an adversary situation. They misunderstood it. And therefore, they felt a separation. Yosef's not part of the team. Each one of us has a role to play, and we have to work together. Yosef's trying to encroach on our roles, so he's not part of the team. Sina, like we explained a week ago or 2 weeks ago, doesn't necessarily mean that you hate somebody, but it means that you feel a separation. And it, by the brothers, for sure, it didn't mean it. It says, then he had the dreams, and they see that it's true. He intends to rule over them, right? He's gonna muscle his way in and become a ruler, right? They're bowing down to him, right? Their sheaves are bowing down to him. The stars are bowing down to him. He's trying to take over. When that wasn't the case, it was a prophetic dream for the future of something that really would happen in the future because of his role of preparing them for their role as a nation, which meant preparing them to be able to go to Mitzrayim, ultimately. But they misunderstood it, and they said, you're trying to get us to accept you as the king over here? That's not your role. So, Vayosifu, they hate him a little bit more. If they hated him, just they hated him. You can't hate somebody more. If you hate him, you don't hate him. But here the idea is, it wasn't that they hated him just out of their gut feeling. They felt that we have to separate ourselves from this guy. He's not part of the team. And then when they heard the dreams, we have to separate ourselves a little bit more. And they did it with a tremendous measure of how much. Now, what did Yaakov do, or Yisrael do, to show Yosef's role? He made him a ksonis pasim. So there's two meanings of what a ksonis pasim is. One is a coat of many colors, and the other is an appellate. Appellate is, if you ever went to the movies, the ushers in the movies, right, had a long time ago, so had appellates on their shoulders. They were, right, some kind of a decoration, right, some kind of decoration. Except here it wasn't on the shoulder, it was around the wrist. Pas means the wrist, pas hayad. So he made Yosef a wristband that showed something special about him. Now, if it's a coat of many colors, what we're saying is very, very apropos. Each brother had a color. Each role in Klal Yisrael is represented by a color. So each brother had their specific color. Yosef had all the colors because he was there to, he was a miniature Yaakov to prepare each one for their role, so you had to have a connection to all the roles. So Yaakov made him a coat of many colors that he was multicolored, multifaceted. That was what it represented. Right? They understood it to mean that he got Yaakov to think that they should take over all the roles. Yosef should muscle his way in on their roles. A wrist, what's the purpose of the wrist? All of the tendons and whatever, the muscles here, the wrist basically takes the kinetic potential energy from the muscles of the arm and transfers it into the fingers so the fingers can make use of the muscle power of the arm. That's what the wrist does. The wrist is a conduit. Yeah, that's a good word. A conduit between the muscles of the arm, the potential and the actual. That's what Yosef was. He was a wrist. He was the one who took the power of the avos and channeled it into the different shvatim. That was what he was supposed to be doing. Why only 10 fingers? I don't know, but that's the purpose, like the wrist. It's interesting, that's Yosef's name. Yosef's name is Pas, Pei Samech, together with two letters, Yud and Vav. The Yud and Vav are letters from God's name. The Yud represents the future, Yihyeh, because God's name is HaYehovah Yihyeh. So the Yud is the Yihyeh, and the Vav is the Hoveh, the present, and the He is the, what's it called, is the past, HaYehovah. The Hoveh, the Vav, is the Vav that makes the Hoveh different, and then there's the Asi, the Yihyeh. Yosef took the present and projected it into the future of God's people by being the pas, by being the wrist. So therefore, his father made him a wristband to show that this was his role. But the brothers misunderstood that as Yaakov feeling that Yosef is going to take over. He has all the roles, and he's going to be the conduit to make sure that everything gets done. So they misunderstood how Yaakov felt, and they saw that Yosef is trying to muscle his way in. Now, Yosef also made a mistake. It says that Vayove Yosef dibosom roa el avihim. Had Yosef come to Yaakov and told him the facts, the brothers are eating flesh taken from an animal after Shechita. They are dealing in a business-like fashion with the women of Canaan. And they think that they're Jews, and therefore their brothers are slaves, then there'd be no problem. Yaakov then could see it in a very objective way and realize that his sons had something different. But Yosef didn't do that. You know, they had in America, I think it was during the Vietnam War, it was a very big problem that the news would give over commentary as news. And they made laws. You have to put on the screen commentary, right? Because people couldn't distinguish between if they're getting facts or they're getting explanation of the facts. That was Yosef's chet. He went to what's it called, to his father, and he didn't tell him the facts. He told them his commentary of the facts, as facts, his conclusions, meaning the brothers are eating Avram and Achai. Because according to me, what they're eating is awesome. He didn't tell them the fact of what they're doing, and therefore Yaakov could have understood that according to them it was something okay. He told them just, they're eating Avram and Achai. He told them that what's it called, they're calling the brothers slaves. He didn't say how it works out. And the same thing with the promiscuity. Had he told him the facts, Yaakov could have investigated himself and realized that according to what the brothers hold, they're not doing anything wrong. But he came to Yaakov, and maybe Yaakov did investigate it. But we're all human, even Yaakov Avinu, and you are influenced by what you hear first. And after that, it's very hard to see things in a different light. You hear something, and then you hear the facts about it, you still are influenced by what you heard to begin with. So that was, and they thought Yosef was doing that on purpose. So now, they consider Yosef a security threat, a national threat to the future of the Jewish people. He is trying to take over, right, and encroach himself on what they're supposed to be doing. And therefore, lo yochlu vayisnu, also they felt separated from him, he's not part of the team. And they couldn't, lo yochlu davro l'shalom. Shalom, we explain, means shleimus, with a team effort, everybody doing their part. They couldn't, he's not part of the team. They couldn't speak to him, l'shalom, because he's not part of the team. He's not part of the shleimus. He wants to do everything. So now, Yosef comes, and they sit as a beis din, and they decide that he is a rodef. Okay, very common word today. Now, he is pursuing them and trying to destroy this nation. And therefore, he has to be eliminated because to save Klal Yisrael, right, Yosef is liable to a death penalty. They thought, the Sfarno says, that he was trying to get into the favor of his father and have him do what Yitzchak did to Esav and what Avraham did to Yishmael, get him out, throw them all out, and he's the only one who's going to remain. So therefore, he is not only trying to kill them in this world, he's trying to kill them for the next world too, which is even worse. So therefore, they had a right, not a right, they had a holy obligation to get rid of this guy. So they sat as a beis din, and they decided to kill him. And then they said, no, you know, okay, really, by rights, we should kill him. But he's our brother. So Reuven said, let's not kill him outright. Let's leave him and let God take care of him. Throw him into a pit with snakes and scorpions. Let God decide whether snakes and scorpions should bite them or not. Yehuda came along and said, "Ma betza kinaru gesachinu." And Targum says, "Ma mamon." What money are we going to get? What benefit are we going to get from killing him? Right? If the whole purpose of killing him is that we want to make sure that he doesn't destroy the future Jewish people, we can accomplish the same thing by selling him as a slave, getting him out of the picture. Why do we have to kill him? But the lashon is very difficult. My mama, what money are we going to get, right? If we kill him, that means if there is money, then we could kill him. But if there's no money, not could I to kill him. Let's just sell him, then we'll get some money for it, whatever. So I have an acute shot in what's the meaning, what Reuven meant, what Yehuda meant. That's the following. Let me first tell you a Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara says like this, that capital cases, you can't decide with a majority of one. There always has to be a majority of two in capital cases. Okay? So you can't have a Sanhedrin of 23 with 12 against 11 for conviction. For acquittal, 12 against 11 helps. But for conviction, you have to have 13 against 10. You can't have, you have to have a majority, at least a majority of two. So, and we learn from Pasuk, Lo siach harei rabim l'ra'os, achrei rabim, you can't go against, you can't go according to the majority to do bad. And doing bad means to kill somebody, he's doing bad to him. So, but you can go after the majority for good. So, Tosfos asks, but in monetary cases also it's bad for somebody, right? If Reuven and Shimon are arguing over who gets the $100, right, it's bad for Reuven, it's good for Shimon. So Tosfos says, therefore it's not bad, it's good. Because it's bad for this one, good for that one. So that evens out. So you can go after a simple majority where it's bad for this one and good for that one, but where it's bad for the guy who's being executed, there you can't. Tosfos says, but by capital cases also it's good for somebody. The Goel Hadam, the relatives of the victim, right, they get a certain satisfaction from having the murder victim, the murderer killed, right? So it's bad for the murderer, but it's good for the family of the victim. So why don't we say the same thing? You could have a simple majority. So Tosfos says, just satisfaction is not enough to offset the bad, that this guy's going to get executed, and they have satisfaction. It has to be hanos mamon. It has to be some benefit that has a monetary benefit. But here there's no monetary benefit, therefore you can't judge with a majority of one. Now, Rashi says that Yosef championed the cause of the brothers from the handmaidens. So the Ramban says, if that's the case, why didn't they stand up for him? Right? Why were all the brothers against him? Pause, one second. So I want to say no. Yeah, they did stand up for him. Now let's see. They sat down as a court. How many people were on the court? 9 people. Hi. Yosef wasn't there, so that's one from the 12. Binyamin wasn't there, that's 2 away, and Reuven wasn't there. So that leaves 9. If the sons of the handmaidens were on Yosef's side, like Rashi says, that means there were 4. So who was against him? 5. 5 against 4 is a simple majority. Said Reuven, said Yehuda, Ma betza ki nargis achinu. Since there's no hanas mamon, there's no monetary benefit, we can't convict him with a simple majority of 5 against 4. Had there been a monetary benefit, then it's good for us, bad for him. Then you can judge with a majority of 1. That's what he said, Ma betza. Mela, to sell him as a slave, we can sell him as a slave with a majority of 1. But we can't kill him with a majority of 1. So therefore, let's not kill him, let's sell him as a slave. Okay, that is, I hope after 120 years I'll be remembered for that. It's a nice word. Okay. I don't know if anyone says that, except you. But in any case, could be, I have to think about it. But in any case, so this is the parasha. They consider themselves 100% vindicated. Yosef considered himself 100%. It was just a mistake. They misunderstood the circumstances.
So why later in the shrine did they have?
And not only that, why did you need the Aseris? What's it called? Asora Arugei Malchus to be Machaper. What was it such a terrible? They made a mistake. The answer is, the Torah tells us it wasn't an innocent mistake. The mistake was generated by something that they caused. Kina. They were jealous. Whatever level the jealousy was, it could be a minute level. But the Torah says, Vayikanu Boecha. They were jealous of him. And we know from the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Hakina, Vahataiva, Vahakavod, Motzina, Sodom, and Olam. That means not just that jealousy takes you out of the world. It takes you out of reality. When you're jealous, or you have a desire, or you're looking for covet, you see things in a distorted way. And because it was their jealousy that set the stage for them to make this mistake, they're held responsible. If it would have been an honest mistake, then people make mistakes. But if the mistake is generated by a bad midah, and the Torah says whatever the level of jealousy was, on their level it was considered, and they therefore are the cause of what came out, then they're responsible. With that, I want to explain a very difficult Gemara. The Gemara says that when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was dying, his students came to bid farewell to him. And he began to cry. They said, Rabbi, why are you crying? He said, if they'd be taking me before an earthly judge, an earthly king, who's here today and tomorrow in the grave, and if he gets angry at me, his anger is only temporal. And what could he do to me? Kill me in this world, but he can't kill me in the next world. I'd be crying. I'd be scared. So surely I'm going now before the King of Kings, who can be angry at me forever, who can, what's it called, if he wants to kill me, he can kill me eternally. And I don't know where I'm going. To Gehenna, Gan Eden, there's two paths before me. So everybody asks, you know, that somebody should be killed in Olam Haba, meaning that he should lose his eternal life forever. You have to be the worst of the worst. You have to be a real Rasha. Did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai really think that he was such a Rasha? Or was he just doing it, you know, to impress his students? I mean, he wouldn't say something at that moment that was totally not true, not in the realm of possibility. He said, I don't even know that, you know, God could punish me. So some say it just means that just the thought, the fright of what could be, even though he knows it's not going to be by him, not himself, going before a king who has that powers. But I want to say, no, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai had a real doubt, and let me tell you why. The Gemara discusses the following. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai finally got out of Yerushalayim in the siege, and his students took him out as if he was dead, and he went to see the Neron Caesar. And he was impressed with him, and he said, what do you want? So he said, I want three things. I want you to leave the Sanhedrin, right? Yavne v'chachomeho, leave the Shoshilta, the Rabban Gamliel, the Nasius, the Nasi, don't kill out all the family of Rabban Gamliel, right? There should be a continuity of the Nasiim, and a doctor to heal Reb Tzadok, those three things. The Gemara discusses, did he make a mistake or not? Why didn't he ask? Spare us. Spare us. Don't destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Go home. Give us another chance. So one opinion said, he realized, Tofasta Merubah, if he would have asked for that, he would have gotten nothing. He asked for what he knew he could get. But more than that, he was afraid that he would end up with nothing. He would ask for too much. They wouldn't give him anything. That would be it. So he asked what he thought he would give him. The second opinion says, no, he made a mistake. But Meshiv HaChomim Ocher, the Rabban Hashem wanted to make that mistake. The Rabban Hashem wanted him to say what really was wrong. He should have asked for the Beis HaMikdash, and they may have granted it, but God didn't want them to not destroy the Beis HaMikdash. So he misled him. God misled Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. It wasn't his fault. God put this into his mind and made him think that better to ask for less than to go all for everything. Okay. That's what the Gemara says. If the Gemara, years and years after Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai died, had this shaila, I'm sure Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai himself had these doubts in his mind. Did I do the right thing or not? He saw that afterwards the temple was destroyed. They gave him what he asked for. I'm sure it plagued him. Should have I asked for more? Should have I gone for everything? And he also had the same doubts. So the Gemara comes to the conclusion is that he wasn't blamed. Wasn't his fault. Okay? Either he was right or God was the one who led him astray on purpose. But Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai didn't know that. So he had a reason to think that maybe he made a mistake. Maybe he should have asked for more. Okay, made a mistake. For that he's going to get Gehenna forever because he made a mistake? Yes. Why? Because he had another possibility. You know why I made that mistake? Not because God led me astray. Because of a different thing, because of covet. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai had an ongoing argument with the Biryonim, right? The thugs of his time, who wanted to rebel against Rome and did not want to capitulate with them. And Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said, we're not on the Madrega to fight them, we should capitulate. Okay, and there was a tremendous machlokas between them. If Rabbi Yochanan Metzlaki had asked that the Beis HaMikdash not be destroyed, and the Romans go home, and they would have accepted it, then they would have had a stalemate between what he held and what they held, because it never would have come to fruition. But if the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, right, because they confronted Rome and didn't capitulate, they burned the storehouses, they forced a rebellion, then Rabbi Yochanan Metzlaki could say, I told you so. And he would be vindicated. That's what he was afraid of. That the reason he didn't ask that the Beis HaMikdash be spared is for covet. That then he could say, I told you so. And if there was even a small chance of that, then he basically caused the whole Churban Beis HaMikdash. And for that, he could get Mises Olam. Even though he could convince himself that he did it with good intentions or whatever, maybe what made him see things wrong wasn't that God made it happen, wasn't that he thought really that that's what's true, but underneath, just like by the Shvatim, there was that Kina, here there was the Kovet. And if that's the case, then yeah, then maybe I deserve Misa Solom. In the end, the Gemara vindicated him. That's not what happened. But he had these thoughts, right? These guilt feelings, maybe, Taka, that was what guided me. And if that's the case, then just like the Shvatim, even though it was a mistake, but it wasn't an honest mistake. It was generated by Kina. Here, maybe it wasn't an honest mistake, it was generated by COVID. That's the same idea. Yeah.
So, Yaakov agreed that they were, but they didn't know how to split reports, simply because he didn't ask?
Yeah. In other words, even if he looked into it afterwards, and he held that they were wrong, but then he would understand, but they held differently. And this is something that hasn't been resolved. But since he heard the fact, he heard the commentary, and not the facts. So once you hear the commentary, it makes an impression on you. And even if you look into it afterwards, it's not so bad, this is the thing, you remain with that first impression. That's the idea. Okay, something to think about.